picked up a young girl, Stephanie Schramm, outside a service station some distance south of Big Sur, probably at Gorda. An attractive 17-year-old, Stephanie was hitchhiking from San Francisco to San Diego, where she was living with her married sister. Manson and Stephanie camped in a nearby canyon that night, probably Salmon or Limekiln Creek, both hippie hangouts, Manson telling her his views on life, love, and death. Manson talked a lot about death, Stephanie would recall, and it frightened her. They took LSD and had sex. Manson was apparently unusually smitten with Stephanie. Usually he'd have sex with a new girl a few times, then move on to a new, young love. Not so with Stephanie. He later told Paul Watkins that Stephanie, who was of German extraction, was the result of 2,000 years of perfect breeding. On August 4th, Manson, still using the stolen credit card, purchased gas at Lucia. Ripping off the place, which bore a large sign reading "Hippies Not Allowed," must have given him a special satisfaction, as he did it again the next day. On the night of the 5th, Manson and Stephanie drove north to a place whose name Stephanie couldn't recall, but which Manson described as a sensitivity camp. It was, he told her, a place where rich people went on weekends to play at being enlightened. He was obviously describing Esalen Institute. Esalen was, at this time, just coming into vogue as a growth center, its seminars including such diverse figures as yogis and psychiatrists, salvationists and Satanists. Obviously, Manson felt Esalen a prime place to espouse his philosophies. It is unknown whether he had been there on prior occasions, those involved in the Institute refusing to even acknowledge his visits there. At 3:07 p.m. July 30th, 1969, someone at the Tate residence called the Esalen Institute, Big Sur, California, telephone number 408-667-2335. It was a brief station-to-station call, total charge 95 cents. It is unknown who placed the call or, since the number is that of the switchboard, who was called. Since the call occurred just 6 days before Charles Manson's visit to Esalen, it arouses a certain amount of speculation. A few things are known, however. None of the Tate victims was at Big Sur during the period Manson was there. Abigail Folger had attended seminars at Esalen in the past, and several of her San Francisco friends visited there periodically. It is possible that she was simply trying to locate someone, but this is just a guess. Though both the call and Manson's visit to Esalen remain mysterious, I should perhaps note that, with a single exception, the Hatami-Tate-Manson confrontation on March 23, 1969, I was unable to find a prior link of any kind between any of the Tate-LaBianca victims and their killers. Manson took his guitar and left Stephanie in the van. After a time, she fell asleep. When she awakened the next morning, Manson had already returned. He was in less than a good mood, as later that day he unexpectedly struck her. Still later, at Barker Ranch, Manson would tell Paul Watkins, to quote Watkins, that while at Big Sur he had gone to Esalen and played his guitar for a bunch of people who were supposed to be the top people there, and they rejected his music. Some people pretended that they were asleep, and other people were saying, "This is too heavy for me, and I'm not ready for that," and others were saying, "Well, I don't understand it," and some just got up and walked out. Still another rejection by what Manson considered the establishment, this occurring just 3 days before the Tate murders. With his single recruit, Manson left Big Sur on August 6th, making gas purchases that same day at San Luis Obispo in Chatsworth, a few miles from Spawn Ranch. According to Stephanie, they had dinner at the ranch that night, and she met the family for the first time. She felt uncomfortable with them, and learning that Manson shared his favors with the other girls, told him she would stay only if he would promise to remain with her and her alone for 2 weeks. Surprisingly, Manson agreed. They spent that night in the van, parked not far from the ranch, then drove to San Diego the next day to pick up Stephanie's clothes. En route, about 10 miles south of Oceanside on Interstate 5, they were stopped by California Highway Patrol Officer Richard C. Willis. though pulled over for a mechanical violation, Manson was cited only for having no valid driver's license in his possession. Manson gave his correct name and the ranch address, and signed the ticket himself. Officer Willis noted on the ticket that Manson was driving a 1952 cream-colored Ford bakery van, license number K70683. The date was Thursday, August 7th, 1969. The time, 6:15 p.m. The ticket, which Patchett and Gutierrez found, proved Manson was in Southern California the day before the Tate murders. While Stephanie was getting her clothes together, Manson talked to her sister, who was also a Beatles fan. She had the White Album, and Manson told her the Beatles had laid out the whole scene in it. He warned her that the blacks were getting ready to overthrow the whites, and that only those who fled to the desert and hid in the bottomless pit would be safe. As for those who remained in the cities, Manson said, people are going to be slaughtered. They'll be lying on their lawns, dead. Just a little over 24 hours later, his prediction would be fulfilled in all its gory detail at 10,050 Cielo Drive, with a little help from his friends. That night, according to Stephanie, she and Charlie parked somewhere in San Diego and slept next to the van, returning to Spawn Ranch the following day, arriving there about 2 p.m. Stephanie was a bit vague when it came to dates. She thought the day they returned to Spawn Ranch was Friday, August 8th, but she wasn't sure. I anticipated that the defense would make the most of this, but I wasn't concerned, because that second piece of evidence conclusively placed Manson back at the ranch on Friday, August 8th, 1969. According to Linda Kasabian, on the afternoon of August 8th, Manson gave Mary Brunner and Sandra Good a credit card and told them to purchase some items for him. At 4 that afternoon, the two girls were apprehended while driving away from a Sears store in San Fernando after store employees checked and found the credit card was stolen. The San Fernando PD arrest report stated that they were driving a van, 1952 Ford, license K70683. Because of the fine job of digging by the LaBianca detectives, we now had physical proof that Manson was back at Spawn Ranch on Friday, August 8th, 1969. Though both the traffic ticket and arrest report were in the discovery materials, so were hundreds of other documents. I was hoping that the defense would overlook their common denominator, that vehicle description with its telltale license number. If Manson went with an alibi defense, and I proved that alibi was fabricated, this would be strong, circumstantial evidence of his guilt. There was, of course, other evidence placing Manson at Spawn Ranch that day. In addition to the testimony of Schramm, DiCarlo, and others, Linda Kasabian said that when the family got together that afternoon, Manson discussed his visit to Big Sur, saying that the people there were really not together, they were just off on their little trips, and that the people wouldn't go on his trip. It was just after this that Manson told them, "Now is the time for Helter Skelter." Bits and pieces, often largely circumstantial, yet patiently dug out and assembled, they became the people's case. And with almost every interview, it became a little stronger. I spent many hours interviewing Stephanie Schramm, who, together with Kitty Lutzinger, had fled Barker Ranch just hours before the October 1969 raid, shotgun-wielding Clem in close pursuit. I often wondered what would have happened to the two girls had the raid been timed just a day later, or Clem been a little faster. Unlike Kitty, Stephanie had severed all contact with the family. Though we had kept her current address from the defense, Squeaky and Gypsy found her working at a dog grooming school. "Charlie wants you to come back," they told her. Stephanie replied, "No thanks." Considering what she knew, her forthright refusal was a brave act. From Stephanie, I learned that while at Barker, Manson had conducted a murder school. He had given a buck knife to each of the girls and had demonstrated how they should slit the throats of pigs by yanking the head back by the hair and drawing the knife from ear to ear, using Stephanie as a very frightened model. He also said they should stab them in either their ears or eyes and then wiggle the knife around to get as many vital organs as possible. The details became even gorier. Manson said that if the police pigs came to the desert, they should kill them, cut them in little pieces, boil the heads, then put the skulls and uniforms on posts to frighten off others. Much later I discovered that LASO deputies George Palmer and William Gleason had obtained much of this same information from Stephanie Schramm on December 3, 1969, but LASO had not informed LAPD of this. Stephanie had told LAPD that Manson had spent the nights of Friday, August 8th and Saturday, August 9th with her. On questioning her, I learned that about an hour after dinner on August 8th, Manson took her to the trailer at Spawn and told her to go to sleep, that he would join her soon. However, she didn't see him again until shortly before dawn the next morning, at which time he awakened her and took her with him to Devil's Canyon, the camp across the road from the ranch. That night, August 9th, Stephanie said, when it got dark, he left, and he came back either sometime during the night or early in the morning. If Manson was planning on using Stephanie Schramm as an alternative alibi, we were now more than ready for him. On March 19th, Hollow Peter, Manson's court-appointed attorney, made two motions: that Charles Manson be given a psychiatric examination and that his case be severed from that of the others. Enraged, Manson tried to fire Hollow Peter. Asked whom he wished to represent him, Manson replied, "Myself." When Judge Keene denied the change, Manson picked up a copy of the Constitution and, saying it meant nothing to the court, tossed it in a wastebasket. Manson eventually requested that Ronald Hughes be substituted for Hollow Peter. Like Reiner and Shin, Hughes had been one of the first attorneys to call on Manson. He had remained on the periphery of the case ever since, his chief function being to run errands for Manson, as indicated by a document Manson had signed on February 17th, designating him one of his legal runners. King granted the substitution. Hollow Peter, whom the press called one of L.A. County's most successful defense attorneys, was out after 13 days. Hughes, who had never before tried a case, was in. Something of an intellectual, Hughes was a huge, balding man with a long, scraggly beard. His various items of apparel rarely matched and usually evidenced numerous food stains. As one reporter remarked, "You could usually tell what Ron had for breakfast for the past several weeks." Hughes, whom I would get to know well in the months ahead, and for whom I developed a growing respect, once admitted to me that he had bought his suits for $1 apiece at MGM. They were from Walter Slezak's old wardrobe. The press was quick to dub him Manson's hippie lawyer. Hughes' first two acts were to withdraw the motions for the psychiatric examination and the severance. Granted. His third and fourth were requests that Manson be allowed to revert to pro per status and to deliver a speech to the court. Denied. Although Manson was displeased with Keene's last two rulings, he couldn't have been too unhappy with the defense team, which now consisted of four attorneys: Reiner, Van Houten, Shin, Atkins, Fitzgerald, Krenwinkel, and Hughes, Manson, each of whom had been associated with him since early in the case. Unknown to us, there were still changes ahead. Among the casualties would be both Ira Reiner and Ronald Hughes, each of whom dared go against Manson's wishes. Reiner would lose considerable time and money for having linked himself with the Manson defense. His loss would be small, however, compared to that of Hughes, who just 8 months later would pay with his life. On March 21st, Aaron and I were walking down the corridor in the Hall of Justice when we spotted Irving Kenerick emerging from the elevator. Although little known elsewhere, Kenerick was something of a legend in the Los Angeles courts. The attorney's obstructionist tactics had caused a number of judges to openly censure him from the bench. Kenerick's stories were so common and usually incredible as to seem fictional when they were actually fact. Prosecutor Burton Katz, for example, recalled that Kenrick once objected to a prosecution witness's stating his own name because, having first heard his name from his mother, it was hearsay. Such frivolous objections were minor irritations compared with Kenrick's dilatory tactics. As samples, in the case of People v. Goodman, Kenrick had stretched a simple theft case, which should have taken a few hours or a day at most to 3 months. The amount stolen, $100. The cost to the taxpayers, $130,212. In the case of People v. Smith and Powell, Kenrick spent 12.5 months on pretrial motions. After an additional 2 months trying to pick a jury, Kenrick's own client fired him in disgust. 1.5 years after Irving Kenrick came onto the case, the jury still hadn't been selected, nor a single witness called. In the case of People v. Bronson, Superior Court Judge Raymond Roberts told Kenrick, "I am doing my best to see that Mr. Bronson gets a fair trial in spite of you. I have never seen such obviously stupid, ill-advised questions of a witness. Are you paid by the word or by the hour that you can consume the court's time? You are the most obstructionist man I have ever met." Outside the presence of the jury, Judge Roberts defined Kenrick's modus operandi as follows. "You take interminable lengths of time in cross-examining on the most minute, unimportant details. You ramble back and forth with no chronology of events to just totally confuse everybody in the courtroom to the utter frustration of the jury, the witnesses, and the judge." After examining the transcript, the appellate court found the judge's remarks were not prejudicial, but were substantiated by the trial record. "All we need, Vince," Aaron remarked jocularly to me, "is to have Irving Kenrick on this case. We'd be in court 10 years. The next day, Ronald Hughes told a reporter that he may ask Van Nuys attorney I.A. Kenrick to enter the case as Manson's lawyer. He mentioned that he and Manson conferred with Kenrick at the county jail Monday night. Though no miracle was involved, the Black Panther whom Charles Manson had shot and killed in July 1969 had resurrected. Only he wasn't a panther, just a former dope dealer, and contrary to what Manson and the family had believed, after Manson shot him, he hadn't died, though his friends had told Manson that he had. His name was Bernard Crow, but he was best known by the descriptive nickname Lots of Papa. Our long search for Crow ended when an old acquaintance of mine, Ed Tolmas, who was Crow's attorney, called me. He told me he had learned we were looking for his client, and arranged for me to interview Crow. After Manson and TJ had left the Hollywood apartment where the shooting took place, Crow, who had been playing dead, told his friends to call an ambulance. They did, then split. When questioned by the police at the hospital, Crow said he didn't know who had shot him or why. He nearly didn't make it. He was on the critical list for 18 days. The bullet was still lodged next to his spine. I was interested in Crow for 2 reasons. One, the incident proved that Charles Manson was quite capable of killing someone on his own. Though I knew I couldn't get this into evidence during the guilt phase of the trial, I was hopeful of introducing it during the penalty phase, when other crimes can be considered. Two, from the description, it appeared that the gun Manson had shot Crow with was the same .22-caliber Longhorn revolver which, just a little over a month later, Tex Watson would use in the Tate homicides. If we could remove the bullet from Crow's body and match it up with the bullets test-fired from the .22-caliber revolver, we'd have placed the Tate murder weapon in Manson's own hand. Sergeant Bill Lee of SID wasn't optimistic about the bullet. He told me that since it had been embedded in the body for over 9 months, it was likely that acids had obliterated the stria to an extent where a positive identification would be difficult. Still, it might be possible. I then talked to several surgeons. They could take out the bullet, they told me, but the operation was risky. I laid it out for Crow. We'd like to have the bullet and would arrange to have it removed at the Los Angeles County Hospital, but there were serious risks involved, and I didn't minimize them. Crow declined the operation. He was sort of proud of the bullet, he said. It made quite a conversation piece. Eventually, Manson would have learned, through discovery, of the resurrection of Bernard Crow. Before this, however, Crow was jailed on a marijuana charge. As he was being escorted down the hall, he passed Manson and his guard, who were on their way back from the attorney room. Charlie did a quick about-face, then told Crow, according to the deputies who were present, "Sorry I had to do it, but you know how it is." Crow's response, if there was one, went unreported. Toward the end of March, the prosecution nearly lost one of its key witnesses. Paul Watkins, once Manson's chief lieutenant, was pulled out of a flaming Volkswagen camper and rushed to Los Angeles County General Hospital with second-degree burns on 25% of his face, arms, and back. When sufficiently recovered to talk to the police, Watkins told them he had fallen asleep while reading by candlelight, and either that or a marijuana cigarette he had been smoking could have caused the fire. These were only guesses, Watkins told them, as he was unsure of the origin of the blaze. 3 days before the fire, Inyo County authorities had heard a rumor that Watkins was going to be killed by the family. As far back as November 1969, I'd asked LAPD to infiltrate the family. I not only wanted to know what they were planning as far as defense strategy was concerned, I told the officers it would be tragic if there was another murder which we could have prevented. I made this request at least 10 times, LAPD finally contending that if they did plant an undercover agent in the family, he would have to commit crimes, for example, smoke marijuana. For there to be a crime, I noted, there had to be criminal intent. If he was doing it as part of his job to catch a criminal, it wouldn't be a crime. When they balked at this, I said he didn't even have to be a police officer. If they had paid informers in narcotics, bookmaking, even prostitution cases, surely they could manage to come up with one in one of the biggest murder cases of our time. No dice. Finally, I turned to the DA's Bureau of Investigation, and they found a young man willing to accept the assignment. I admired his determination, but he was clean-cut, with short hair, and looked as straight as they come. As desperate as we were for information, I couldn't send him into that den of killers. Once they stopped laughing, they'd chop him to pieces. Eventually, I had to abandon the idea. We remained in the dark as to what the family was planning to do next. April 1970. The words pig, death to pigs, rise, and helter-skelter contain only 13 different letters. Handwriting experts told me it would be extremely difficult, if not impossible, to match the bloody words found at the Tate and LaBianca residences with printing exemplars obtained from the defendants. It wasn't only the small number of letters involved. The words were printed, not written. The letters were oversize. In both cases, unusual writing implements had been used, a towel at the Tate residence, probably a rolled-up piece of paper at the LaBiancas. And all but the two words found on the refrigerator door at the latter residence had been printed high up on the walls, the person responsible having to stretch unnaturally high to make them. As evidence, they appeared worthless. However, thinking about the problem, I came up with an idea which, if successful, could convert them into very meaningful evidence. It was a gamble, but if it worked, it would be worth it. We knew who had printed the words. Susan Atkins had testified before the grand jury that she had printed the word pig on the front door of the Tate House, while Susan had told me when I interviewed her that Patricia Krenwinkel had admitted printing the words at the LaBiancas. Though Susan's grand jury testimony and her statements to me were inadmissible because of the deal we had made with her, she had confessed the printing at Tate to Ronnie Howard, so we had her on that. But we had nothing admissible on Krenwinkel. The Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution provides that no person shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself. The U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that this is limited to verbal utterances and that a defendant cannot refuse to give physical evidence of himself, like appearing in a lineup, submitting to a breath analysis test for drunken driving, giving fingerprint and handwriting exemplars, hair samples, and so on. After researching the law, I drew up very explicit instructions for Captain Carpenter at Sybil Brand, stating exactly how to request the printing exemplars of Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkel, and Leslie Van Houten. Each was to be informed, 1. You have no constitutional right to refuse. 2. You have no constitutional right to have your attorney present. 3. Your constitutional right to remain silent does not include the right to withhold printing exemplars. And 4, if you submit to this process, this can be used as evidence by the prosecution in your case. Captain Carpenter assigned Senior Deputy H.L. Mouse to obtain the exemplars. According to my instructions, she informed Susan Atkins of the above, then told her, "The word pig was printed in blood at the Tate residence. We want you to print the word pig." Susan, without complaint, printed the exemplar as requested. Leslie Van Houten and Patricia Krenwinkel were brought in individually and given similar instructions concerning their rights. However, each was told orally, "The words helter-skelter, death to pigs, and rise were printed in blood at the LaBianca residence. We want you to print those words." In my memo to Captain Carpenter, there was one additional instruction for the deputy. Do not write any of this for them. I wanted to see if Krenwinkel misspelled helter as heelter, as she had on the refrigerator door. Leslie Van Houten printed the exemplar. Patricia Krenwinkel refused. We'd won the gamble. We could now use her refusal in the trial as circumstantial evidence of her guilt. As evidence, this was doubly important, since before this I'd had absolutely no independent evidence corroborating Linda Kasabian's testimony regarding Patricia Krenwinkel's involvement in the LaBianca murders. And without corroborating evidence as a matter of law, Krenwinkel would have been entitled to an acquittal on those charges. Though we'd won that gamble, Krenwinkel herself could just as easily have emerged the winner. Leslie could have refused to make an exemplar also, which would have diluted the force of Katie's refusal. Or Katie could have made the exemplar, the handwriting experts then failing to match her printing with that found at the LaBianca's. We were less lucky when it came to putting the Tate-Sebring rope and the wire cutters in Manson's possession before the murders, evidence I was counting on to provide the necessary corroboration of Linda Kasabian's testimony as to Manson. We knew from DiCarlo, who had been present, that Manson had purchased about 200 feet of the white three-strand nylon rope at the Jack Frost surplus store in Santa Monica in June 1969. However, when Tate detectives finally interviewed Frost, 3.5 months after my initial request, he was unable to find a purchase order for the rope. Nor could he definitely state that this was the same rope he had stocked. Frost recalled stocking some three-strand white nylon rope, but he believed it was 1/2 inch thick. The Tate-Sebring rope was 5/8 inch thick. While it was possible that Frost had been mistaken or the rope had been mislabeled, the defense could argue that it simply wasn't the same rope. An attempt to identify the manufacturer, then trace it back to Frost, also failed. Frost usually picked up his stock in odd lots from jobbers or through auctions, rather than directly from the manufacturer. Just as these were blind alleys, so was one other. Literally. According to DiCarlo, Manson had given part of the rope to George Spahn for use on the ranch. Spahn's near blindness, however, eliminated him as a witness. It was then I thought of Ruby Pearl. For some reason, though the police had visited Spahn Ranch numerous times, none of the officers had interviewed Ruby, George's ranch manager. I found her a fund of valuable information. Examining the Tate-Sebring rope, she not only said it looked like the rope Manson had, she also supplied numerous examples of Manson's domination, recalled seeing the .22 Longhorn at the ranch many times, identified the leather thong found at the La Bianca's as similar to the ones Manson often wore, and told me that prior to the arrival of the family at Spahn, she had never seen any buck knives there, but that in the summer of 1969, suddenly it seemed everyone had one. While disappointed that we couldn't obtain documented proof of the rope sale, I was pleased with Ruby. Being an experienced horse wrangler, as well as a tough, gallant lady who showed not the slightest fear of the family, her testimony would carry weight. There was a fine streak of stubborn authority about her. When Manson was brought to Los Angeles from Independence, Ruby Pearl visited him at the jail. "I only came here for one reason, Charlie," she told him. "I want to know where Shorty was buried." Manson, unwilling to meet her gaze, looked down at the floor and remarked, "Ask the Black Panthers." "Charlie, you know the Black Panthers have never been up to the ranch," she responded, turning her back on him and walking out. Another find was Randy Starr, whom I interviewed the same day as Ruby. A sometime movie stuntman who specialized in fake hangings, Starr said the Tate Sebring rope was identical to a rope he'd once used to help Manson pull a vehicle out of the creek bed. Starr told me Manson always kept the rope behind the seat in his dune buggy. Even more important was Randy Starr's positive identification of the .22 Longhorn revolver, for Starr had once owned the gun and had given it to Manson. The gun, serial number 1902708, had been among a number of weapons taken from the archery headquarters in El Monte, California, during a burglary on the night of March 12, 1969. According to Starr, he obtained it in a trade with a man known only as Ron. Manson was always borrowing the gun for target practice, and Randy finally gave it to him in trade for a truck that had belonged to Danny DiCarlo. One question remained unanswered. Why on the night of the Tate murders did the killers bring along 43 feet 8 inches of rope? To tie up the victims? Manson accomplished this the next night with a single leather thong. I obtained a glimpse of a possible answer during one of my interviews with DiCarlo. According to Danny, in late July of 1969, Manson had told him that the establishment pigs ought to have their throats cut and be hung up by their feet. This would really throw the fear into people, Manson said. The logical inference, I felt, was that the killers brought along the rope intending to hang their victims. It was only a guess, but I suspected it was correct. The wire cutters presented their own problems. Linda Kasabian said the pair found in Manson's dune buggy looked like the pair that had been in the car that night. Fine. Joe Granato of SID used them to test cut a section of the Tate telephone wire and concluded that the two cuts were the same. Great. But then Officer Dwayne Wolfer, considered LAPD's foremost expert on physical evidence, made some test cuts also, and he concluded that these wire cutters couldn't have been the ones used. Not about to give up, I asked Wolfer if the tautness of the wire could have been a factor. Possibly, he said. I then asked Wolfer to accompany telephone company representatives to 10,050 Cielo Drive and make another cut, only this time I wanted him to sever the wire while it was strung up and tight, the way it was the night of the murders. Wolfer eventually made the test, but his opinion remained unchanged. The actual cut made on the night of the murders and the test cut did not match. While it was possible that the cutting edge of the wire cutters could have been damaged subsequent to the Tate murders, Wolfer's tests literally severed this important link between Manson and the Tate evidence. When I'd accompanied LAPD to Spahn Ranch on November 19, 1969, we'd found a number of .22 caliber bullets and shell casings. Because of the terrific windstorm and the necessity of following up other leads, our search had been cursory, however, and I'd asked Sergeant Lee to return and conduct a more thorough search. The much-repeated request became even more important when, on December 16, 1969, LAPD obtained the .22 caliber Longhorn revolver. Yet it was not until April 15, 1970, that Lee returned to spawn. Again concentrating on the gully area some 200 feet behind George Spawn's residence, Lee found 23 more 22 caliber shell casings. Since 22 had been found during the first search, this brought the total to 45. None of the 22 caliber bullets recovered during the two searches matched up with the bullets found at the murder scene or those test-fired from the weapon. It was not until after the latter search that Lee ran comparison tests on any of the Spawn shell casings. When he finally did, he concluded that 15 of the 45 had been fired from the Tate murder gun. Lee determined this by comparing the rim marks on the Spawn shell casings with, 1, the rim marks on the shell casings found in the cylinder of the weapon, 2, the rim marks of shell casings test-fired from the gun, and 3, the firing pin of the gun. Belatedly, but fortunately in time for the trial, we now had scientific evidence linking the gun to Spawn Ranch. Only one thing would have made me happier. If Lee had returned and found the rest of the shell casings before the gun was discovered. As it was, the defense could contend that during the 4.5 months between the two searches, the police and or prosecution had planted this evidence. For months, one item of physical evidence had especially worried me, the pair of eyeglasses found near the trunks in the living room at the Tate murder scene. The natural conclusion was that if they didn't belong to any of the victims, they must belong to one of the killers. Yet neither Watson, Atkins, Krenwinkel, nor Kasabian wore glasses. I anticipated that the defense would lean heavily on this, arguing that since they didn't belong to any of the defendants, at least one of the killers was still at large. From there, it was only a short step to the conclusion that maybe the wrong people were on trial. This posed an extremely serious problem for the prosecution. That problem, though not the mystery itself, vanished when I talked to Roseanne Walker. Since Susan Atkins had confessed the murders to both Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard, it occurred to me that she might have made incriminating statements to others. So I asked LAPD to locate any girls Atkins had been particularly close to at Sybil Brand. One former inmate who agreed to talk to me, though she wasn't very happy about it, was Roseanne Walker. A pathetic, heavy-set black girl who had been sent to Sybil Brand on 5 drug-related charges, Roseanne had been a sort of walking commissary, selling candy, cigarettes, and makeup to the other inmates. Not until the 5th or 6th time I interviewed her did Roseanne recall a conversation which, though it seemed unimportant to her, I found very significant. Susan and Roseanne were listening to the radio one day when the newscaster began talking about a pair of eyeglasses LAPD had found at the Tate murder scene. Amused, Susan remarked, "Wouldn't it be too much if they arrested the person the glasses belonged to when the only thing he was guilty of was losing his glasses?" Roseanne replied that maybe the glasses did belong to the killer. Susan said, "That ain't the way it went down." Susan's remark clearly indicated that the glasses did not belong to the killers. Other problems remained. One of the biggest concerned Linda Kasabian's escape from Spawn Ranch. Linda told me that she decided to flee after the night of the LaBianca murders. However, Manson sent her to the waterfall area later that day, August 11th, and she was afraid to leave that night because of the armed guards he had posted. Early the next morning, August 12th, Manson sought her out. She was to put on a straight dress, then take a message to Mary Brunner and Sandra Good at Sybil Brand, as well as Bobby Beausoleil at the county jail. The message? Say nothing. Everything's all right. After borrowing a car from Dave Hannum, a new ranch hand at Spawn, Linda went to Sybil Brand, but learned that Brunner and Good were in court. At the county jail, her identification was rejected, and she wasn't allowed to see Beausoleil. When she returned to the ranch and told Manson she had been unsuccessful, he told her to try again the next day. Linda saw her chance. That night she packed a shoulder bag with some clothing and Tanya's diapers and pins and hid it in the parachute room. Early the next morning, August 13th, she again borrowed Hannum's car. On going to get the bag, however, she found Manson and Stephanie Schramm sleeping in the room. Deciding to forget the bag, she went to get Tanya, but discovered that the children had been moved to the waterfall area. There was no way she could go there to get Tanya, she said, without having to explain her actions. So she left the ranch without her. Instead of going to Los Angeles as instructed, Linda began driving to Taos, New Mexico, where her husband was now living. Hannum's car broke down outside Albuquerque. When she tried to have it repaired, using a credit card Bruce Davis had earlier given her for gas, the gas station owner checked and learned the card was no longer valid. Linda then wrote a letter to Hannum, enclosing the keys, telling him where he could find the car and apologizing. She then hitchhiked the rest of the way. Susan Atkins apparently intercepted the letter, as she gave Hannum the information and keys, but didn't show him the rest of the letter. Understandably unhappy, Hannum took a bus to Albuquerque to reclaim the vehicle. Linda found her husband living with another girl in a commune at Lorien, outside Taos. She told him about the Tate murders, the events of the second night, and leaving Tanya at Spawn. Bob Kasabian suggested they return to Spawn together and get Tanya, but Linda was afraid Manson would kill them all. Kasabian said he wanted to think about it for a few days. Unwilling to wait, Linda hitchhiked into Taos and went to see Joe Sage. Sage, who had a reputation for helping people, was a rather colorful character. When the 51-year-old Zen monk wasn't busy running his macrobiotic church, he was campaigning for president of the United States on an anti-pollution ticket. Linda asked Sage for enough money to return to Los Angeles to get her little girl. Sage, however, began questioning Linda, and eventually she told him and a youth named Jeffrey Jacobs about the murders. Not believing Linda's tale, Sage placed a call to Spawn Ranch, talking first to an unidentified girl, then to Manson himself. Sage asked Manson, whose reaction can only be imagined, if Linda's story was true. Manson told him Linda had flipped out, that her ego was not ready to die, and so she had run away. Linda did not talk to Charlie, but she did talk to one of the other girls. She believed, but was not sure it was Squeaky, who told her about the August 16th raid. The authorities had kept Tanya, she learned. She was now in a foster home. Linda also spoke to Patricia Krenwinkel, Katie saying something to the effect, "You just couldn't wait to open your big mouth, could you?" Linda subsequently called the Malibu police station and learned the name of the social worker who was handling Tanya's case. On calling the social worker, Linda learned that another girl, posing as Tanya's mother, had attempted to reclaim Tanya a short time before. Though I couldn't prove it, I suspected that Manson had sent one of his girls to get Tanya as insurance that Linda wouldn't talk. Sage gave Linda enough money for round-trip airfare, as well as the name of a Los Angeles attorney, Gary Fleischman, who he felt might be able to help her reclaim Tanya. When Linda saw Fleischman, she did not tell him about the murders, only that she had left the ranch to look for her husband. Eventually, after a court hearing, the mother and daughter were reunited and flew back to Taos. Bob was still involved with the other girl, however, and Linda took Tanya and hitchhiked first to Miami, Florida, where her father was living, then to her mother's home in Concord, New Hampshire. It was here, on December 2nd, 1969, when the news broke that she was being sought in connection with the Tate murders, that Linda turned herself into the local police. Waiving extradition, she was returned to Los Angeles the next day. I asked Linda, why, between the time you reclaimed Tanya and the date of your arrest in December, didn't you contact the police and tell them what you knew about the murders? She was afraid of Manson, Linda said, afraid that he might find and kill both her and Tanya. Also, she was pregnant and didn't want to go through this ordeal until after the baby was born. There were, of course, other reasons, the most important being her distrust of the police. In the drug-oriented world she inhabited, police were considered neither friends nor allies. I felt that this explanation, if properly argued, would satisfy the jury. An even bigger question remained. How could you leave your daughter in that den of killers? I was concerned not only with the jury's reaction to this, but also with the use to which the defense could put it. That Linda had left Tanya with Manson and the others at Spawn Ranch could be circumstantial evidence that she did not really believe them to be killers, clearly contradicting the main thrust of her testimony. Therefore, both the question and her answer became extremely important. Linda replied that she felt Tanya would be safe there, just so long as she did not go to the police. Something within me told me that Tanya would be all right, Linda said, that nothing would happen to her, and that now was the time to leave. I knew I would come back and get her. I was just confident that she would be all right. Would the jury accept this? I didn't know. This was among my many concerns, as the trial date drew ever closer. When contacted by Lieutenant Helder and Sergeant Gutierrez, both Sage and Jacobs verified Linda's story. I was unable to use either as a witness, however, most of their testimony being inadmissible hearsay. Ranch hand David Hannum said he had begun work at Spawn on August 12th, and that Linda had borrowed his car that same day, as well as the next. And a check of the jail records verified that Brunner and Good had been in court on August 12th. The various interviews yielded unexpected bonuses. Hannum said that once when he killed a rattlesnake, Manson had angrily castigated him, yelling, "How would you like it if I chopped your head off?" He then added, "I'd rather kill people than animals." At the same time I interviewed Linda's husband, Robert Kasabian, I also talked to Charles Melton, the hippie philanthropist from whom Linda had stolen the $5,000. Melton said that in April 1969, before Linda ever met the family, he had gone to Spawn Ranch to see Paul Watkins. While there, Melton had met Tex, who, admiring Melton's beard, commented, "Maybe Charlie will let me grow a beard someday." It would be difficult to find a better example of Manson's domination of Watson. These were pluses. There were minuses. And they were big ones. To prove to the jury that Linda's account of these two nights of murder wasn't fabricated out of whole cloth, I desperately needed some third person to corroborate any part of her story. Rudolph Weber provided that corroboration for the first night, but for the second night, I had no one. I gave LAPD this all-important priority assignment. Find the two officers who spoke to Manson and Linda on the beach, the man whose door Linda knocked on that night, the man and woman at the house next to the Malibu feed bin, or any of the drivers who gave them rides. I'd like to have had all these people, but if they could turn up even one, I'd be happy. Linda had located the spot where the two police officers stopped and questioned them. It was near Manhattan Beach. But Los Angeles being the megalopolis that it is, it turned out to be an area where there were overlapping jurisdictions, not one but three separate law enforcement agencies patrolling it, and a check of all three failed to turn up anyone who could recall such an incident. We had better luck when it came to locating the actor Linda had mentioned. LaBianca detectives Sartucci and Nielsen found him still living in apartment 501, 1101 Oceanfront Walk, Venice. Not Israeli, but Lebanese, his name was Saladin Nader, age 39. Unemployed since starring in Broken Wings, the movie about the poet Khalil Gibran, he remembered picking up the two hitchhiking girls in early August 1969. He described both Sandy and Linda accurately, including the fact that Sandy was noticeably pregnant, picked out photos of each, and related essentially the same story Linda had told me, neglecting to mention only that he and Linda had gone to bed. After questioning Nader, the investigating officers, according to their report, explained to subject the purpose of the interview, and he displayed amazement that such sweet and sociable young ladies would attempt to inflict any harm upon his body after he assisted them to the best of his ability. Though their stories jibed, Nader was only partial support for Linda's testimony, as, fortunately for him, and thanks to Linda, he did not encounter the group that night. One floor down was the apartment of the man on whose door Linda had knocked. Linda had pointed out the door, 403, for us, and I'd asked Gutierrez and Patchett to try to locate the man, hopeful he'd recall the incident. When I got their report, it was on the tenant of 404. Returning, they learned from the landlady that 403 had been vacant during August 1969. It was possible some transient may have been staying there, she said. It wouldn't have been the first time. But beyond that, we drew a blank. According to the rental manager of 3921 Topanga Canyon Boulevard, the house next to the Malibu feed bin where Linda said she, Sadie, and Clem had stopped just before dawn, a group of hippies had moved into the unrented building about 9 months ago. There had been, he said, as many as 50 different persons living there, but he didn't know any of them. Sartucci and Nielsen, however, did manage to locate two young girls who had lived there from about February to October 1969. Both were friends of Susan Atkins, and both recalled meeting Linda Kasabian. One recalled that once Susan, another girl, and a male had visited them. She remembered the incident, though not the date, the time, or the other persons present, because she was on acid, and the trio appeared evil. Both girls admitted that during this period they were stoned so much of the time, their recollections were hazy. As witnesses, they would be next to useless. Nor was LAPD able to locate any of the drivers who had picked up the hitchhikers that night. The LaBianca detectives handled all these investigations. Going over their reports, I was convinced that they had done everything possible to run down the leads. But we were left with the fact that of the 6 to 8 persons who could have corroborated Linda Kasabian's story of the events of that second night, we hadn't found even one. I anticipated that the defense would lean heavily on this. Any defendant may file at least one affidavit of prejudice against a judge and have him removed from the case. It isn't even necessary to give a reason for such a challenge. On April 13th, Manson filed such an affidavit against Judge William Keene. Judge Keene accepted Manson's challenge, and the case was reassigned to Judge Charles H. Older. Though more affidavits were expected, each defendant was allowed one, the defense attorneys, after a brief huddle, decided to accept Older. I'd never tried a case before him. By reputation, the 52-year-old jurist was a no-nonsense judge. A World War II fighter pilot who had served with the Flying Tigers, he had been appointed to the bench by Governor Ronald Reagan in 1967. This would be his biggest case to date. The trial date was set for June 15th. Because of the delay, we were again hopeful that Watson might be tried with the others, but that hope was quickly dashed when Watson's attorney requested and received still another postponement in the extradition proceedings. The retrial of Beausoleil for the Hinman murder had begun in late March. Chief witness for the prosecution was Mary Brunner, first member of the Manson family, who testified that she had witnessed Beausoleil stab Hinman to death. Brunner was given complete immunity in exchange for her testimony. Claiming that he had only been a reluctant witness, Beausoleil himself took the stand and fingered Manson as Hinman's murderer. The jury believed Brunner. In Beausoleil's first trial, the case against him had been so weak that our office hadn't asked for the death penalty. This time, prosecutor Burton Katz did, and got it. Two things concerned me about the trial. One was that Mary Brunner did everything she could to absolve Manson, making me wonder just how far Sadie, Katie, and Leslie would be willing to go to save Charlie, and the other, that Danny DiCarlo hedged on many of his previous statements to LAPD. I was worried that Danny might be getting ready to split, all too aware that he had little reason to stick around. Though the motorcycle engine theft charge had been dropped in return for his testimony in the Hinman case, we had made no deal with him on Tate LaBianca. Moreover, although he had a good chance of sharing the $25,000 reward, it was not necessary that he testify to obtain it. DiCarlo and Brunner did testify that same month before the grand jury, which brought additional indictments against Charles Manson, Susan Atkins, and Bruce Davis on the Hinman murder. But testifying before a grand jury in secret and having to face Manson himself in court were two different things. Nor could I blame Danny for being apprehensive. As soon as the grand jury indictments were made public, Davis, who had been living with the family at Spawn, vanished. May 1970. In early May, Crockett, Poston, and Watkins encountered Clem, Gypsy, and a youth named Kevin, one of the newer family members, in Shoshone. Clem told Watkins, "Charlie says that when he gets out, you all had better not be around the desert." From a source at Spawn Ranch, we learned that family members there appeared to be preparing for some activity. The Manson girls were interviewed so often that they were on a first-name basis with many of the reporters. Inadvertently, several times they implied that Charlie would be out soon. Perhaps significantly, the girls said nothing about his being acquitted or released. It was obvious that something was being planned. On May 11th, Susan Atkins filed a declaration repudiating her grand jury testimony. Both Manson and Atkins used the declaration as basis for habeas corpus motions, which were subsequently denied. Aaron and I conferred with District Attorney Younger. Sadie couldn't have it both ways. Either she had told the complete truth before the grand jury, and according to our agreement, we would not seek a first-degree murder conviction against her, or according to her recent declaration, she recanted her testimony, in which case the agreement was breached. My personal opinion was that Susan Atkins had testified substantially truthfully before the grand jury, with these exceptions. Her omissions of the three other murder attempts the second night, her hedging on whether she had stabbed Wojtek Frankowski, which she had admitted to me when I interviewed her, and my instinctive but strong feeling, corroborated by her confessions to Virginia Graham and Ronnie Howard, that she had lied when she testified that she had not stabbed Sharon Tate. Under Atkins' agreement with our office, substantially wasn't good enough. She had to tell the complete truth. With her declaration, however, the issue was closed. On the basis of her repudiation, Aaron and I asked Younger's permission to seek the death penalty against Susan Atkins, as well as the other defendants. He granted it. Sadie's about-face was not unexpected. Another change, however, caught almost everyone off guard. In court to petition for a new trial, Bobby Beausoleil produced an affidavit, signed by Mary Brunner, stating that her testimony in his trial was not true, and that she had lied when she said Beausoleil stabbed Hinman to death. Although obviously stunned, Prosecutor Bert Katz argued that the other evidence in the trial was sufficient to convict Beausoleil. Investigating further, Bert learned that a few days before she was due to testify, Mary Brunner had been visited by Squeaky and Brenda at her parents' home in Wisconsin. She was again visited by Squeaky, this time accompanied by Sandy, 2 days before she signed the affidavit. Bert charged that the girls, representing Manson, had coerced Mary Brunner into repudiating her testimony. Called to the stand, Mary Brunner first denied this, then after conferring with counsel, did another about-face and repudiated her repudiation. Her testimony in the trial was true, she said. Still later, she again reversed herself. Eventually, Beausoleil's motion for a new trial was denied, and he was sent to San Quentin's death row to wait out his appeal. The district attorney's office was left with a perplexing legal dilemma, however. After her testimony in the Beausoleil trial, the court had granted Mary Brunner complete immunity for her part in the Hinman murder. Except for the possibility that she might be tried for perjury, it looked as if Mary Brunner had managed to beat the rap. Indicted on the Hinman murder, Manson appeared before Judge Dell to request that he be allowed to represent himself. When Dell denied the motion, Manson requested that Irving Kennerick and Day Shin be made his attorneys. Judge Dell ruled there would be a clear conflict of interest if Shin represented both Manson and Susan Atkins. This left Kenrick. Commenting, "I think we are well aware of Mr. Kenrick and his record," Manson told Judge Dell. "I do not wish to hire this man as my attorney, but you leave me no alternative. I understand what I am doing. Believe me, I understand what I am doing. This is the worst man in town I could pick, and you are pushing him on me." If Dell would permit him to represent himself, Manson said, then he would forget about having Kenrick.